Some of All Fears, by Tom Clancy. Broken Arrow. Part 1. Like a Wolf on the Fold. In recounting the Syrian attack on the Israeli-held Golan Heights at 1400 local time on Saturday, October 6, 1973, most commentators automatically recalled Lord Byron's famous line. There is also little doubt that that is precisely what the more literately inclined Syrian commanders had in mind when they placed the final touches on the operation's plans that would hurl more tanks and guns at the Israelis than any of Hitler's vaunted Panzer generals had ever dreamed of having. However, the sheep found by the Syrian army that grim October day were more like bighorn rams in autumn rut than the more docile kind found in pastoral verse. Outnumbered by roughly 9-1, the two Israeli brigades on the Golan were crack units. The 7th Armored Brigade held the northern Golan and scarcely budged, its defensive network a delicate balance of rigidity and flexibility. Individual strong points held stubbornly, channeling the Syrian penetrations into rocky defile, where they could be pinched off and smashed by roving bands of Israeli armor which lay in wait behind the purple line. By the time reinforcements began arriving on the second day, the situation was still in hand, but barely. By the end of the fourth day, the Syrian tank army that had fallen upon the 7th lay a smoking ruin before it. The barrack known as the Thunderbolt Brigade held the southern heights and was less fortunate. Here the terrain was less well suited to the defense, and here also the Syrians appear to have been more ably led. Within hours the barrack had been broken into several fragments. Though each piece would later prove to be as dangerous as a nest of vipers, the Syrian spearheads were quick to exploit the gaps and race towards their strategic objective, the Sea of Galilee. The situation that developed over the next 36 hours would prove to be the gravest test of Israeli arms since 1948. Reinforcements began arriving on the second day. These had to be thrown into the battle area piecemeal, plugging holes, blocking roads, even rallying units that had broken under the desperate strain of combat and, for the first time in Israeli history, fled the field before the advancing Arabs. Only on the third day were the Israelis able to assemble their armored fist, first enveloping, then smashing the three deep Syrian penetrations. The changeover to offensive operations followed without pause. The Syrians were hurled back towards their own capital by a wrathful counterattack, and surrendered a field littered with burned-out tanks and shattered men. At the end of this day the troopers of the barrack and the 7th heard over their unit radio nets a message from Israeli Defense Forces High Command. You have saved the people of Israel. And so they had. Yet outside Israel, except for schools in which men learn the profession of arms, this epic battle is strangely unremembered. As in the Six-Day War of 1967, the more freewheeling operations in the Sinai were the ones that attracted the excitement and admiration of the world, bridging the Suez, the Battle of the Chinese Farm, the encirclement of the Egyptian Third Army, this despite the fearful implications of the Golan fighting, which was far closer to home. Still, the survivors of those two brigades knew what they had done, and their officers could revel in the knowledge that among professional soldiers who know the measure of skill and courage that such a stand entails, their battle for the heights would be remembered with Thermopylae, Bastogne and Gloucester Hill. Each war knows many ironies, however, and the October War was no exception. As is true of most glorious defensive stands, this one was largely unnecessary. The Israelis had misread intelligence reports which, had they been acted on as little as 12 hours earlier, would have enabled them to execute preset plans and pour reserves onto the heights hours before the onslaught commenced. Had they done so, there would have been no heroic stand. There would have been no need for their tankers and infantrymen to die in numbers so great that it would be weeks before the true casualty figures were released to a proud, but grievously wounded nation. Had the information been acted upon, the Syrians would have been massacred before the Purple Line for all their lavish collection of tanks and guns, and there is little glory in massacres. This failure of intelligence has never been adequately explained. Did the fabled Mossad fail so utterly to discern the Arabs' plans? Or did Israeli political leaders fail to recognize the warnings they received? These questions received immediate attention in the world press, of course, most particularly in regard to Egypt's assault crossing of the Suez, which breached the vaunted Barlev Line. Equally serious but less well appreciated was a more fundamental error made years earlier by the usually prescient Israeli general staff. For all its firepower, the Israeli army was not heavily outfitted with tube artillery, particularly by Soviet standards. Instead of heavy concentrations of mobile field guns, the Israelis chose to depend heavily on large numbers of short-range mortars and attack aircraft. This left Israeli gunners on the heights outnumbered 12-1, subject to crushing counter-battery fire, and unable to provide adequate support to the beleaguered defenders. That error cost many lives.